It is said that of all the topics that the Buddha spoke about, that he spoke more about right effort than any other topic. There's many ways to think about right effort, whether it's right effort or wise effort or balanced energy or however you approach it. There are many ways to talk about it, and the Buddha categorized right effort or balanced energy as one of the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, one of the ten paramis, or the perfections of mind, forces of purity, one of the seven factors of awakening or enlightenment, one of the five powers, one of the five faculties, one of the four means for accomplishing your aspiration, and all four of the four right efforts. So, right effort has a pretty distinguished pedigree. So, if the Buddha spoke so much about right effort or balanced energy, we could ask ourselves, or we could wonder why. Why would that be the most talked about topic instead of mindfulness or liberation or any other of the many important understandings to come from practice? And when I asked myself that question, two reflections come to mind. One is that what we're trying to do here, to turn the momentum of the mind away from defilements and delusion towards awareness and understanding, liberation. That is not an insignificant task. It is really about the most you could ask of anyone or of yourself to do. It really would be and is it's a noble endeavor and would certainly be a supreme achievement or accomplishment to even get halfway along. You know, because we know, looking at our own mind, that just how much of the time we're lost in habits of mind or reacting in defiled ways, either within our mind or with speaking or acting out. And the Buddha pointed to the possibility, and he himself realized, and many, many men and women since the time of the Buddha have also realized, that the mind can be freed from the clutches of defilement. Even on a retreat like this, even though it's only 9 days, all of you have done retreats before, most of you have done retreats before, and you can see that with the continuity of effort and attention, that even in 9 days you can see a noticeable shift in the mind. No, nothing is completely uprooted, and no, it's not permanent, but you can see the path. You know the path. The path is in the same direction as we've been working on retreat. It's to greater continuity of awareness, more understanding of and quicker recognition of our own states of mind and how to understand them in a way that we're not identified with them and we're not limited by them. And if you could imagine being in a position where you could continue to develop your mind in this way in the course of a lifetime, there'd be a significant shift in the mind. If a 9-day retreat reveals this much, a lifetime would have a noticeable effect. And that's what we're all being encouraged to consider, is making this practice of awareness. And I don't mean the format of a retreat, but I mean the practice of awareness, a lifestyle choice, to bring it into our lives, whatever it is we have to do. Whether we have careers or families or parents to care for or health problems or not, it's just whatever we're doing with our life to make it a lifestyle of awareness. And so to get the encouragement, the instruction, the inspiration, the confidence to do that, it takes a lot of encouragement, a lot of talking, a lot of support, a lot of, well, speaking about right effort. The second reflection that comes to my mind is that everything, any accomplishment, takes effort. To write a book, get a degree, hold a job, navigate the terrain of a relationship, anything takes effort. Even the luck of winning the lottery, you've got to make the effort to buy the ticket. You know, it's just anything, everything takes effort, energy. And the more skillful, the more precise, the more directly applied that energy is, the more effective the result. So too in the awakening of the mind, or the disentangling of the mind from the clutches of the defilements, it is how we apply our energy, how much energy we apply, how continuously we apply it, that will be the cause for the resultant liberation of mind. There's no other way around it. It doesn't happen, as I had imagined for many years, just pop, plof, whoa. You know, it just kind of falls out of the tree on me one day. Lucky me, you know. Wish it were so, huh? One thing I've noticed over the time of my practice, and that I see in others, not only many of you, but many of my colleagues, is that our understanding of balanced effort, balanced energy, right effort, changes with practice. It might seem like we, you know, in the beginning, we need a tremendous amount of gear it up. It's almost gears and pulleys and, you know, muscular effort to get to the cushion. And later on in practice, with some momentum, whether it's in a retreat or after a decade or so of practice, right effort is much, we have a better understanding. We have a more empirical, you know, understanding of what right effort is. And so we really refine our understanding with practice. We try, we see the result, and we make an adjustment in order to find the middle path of effort or energy. We have to hit the extremes. We'll hit the extreme of too much effort and striving and too energized, and we'll go to the other extreme of too lackadaisical, too relaxed, too disinterested, too imprecise. And it's by recognizing the imbalance that we're able to make a correction towards more balance. And the swings of wrong effort, wrong energy, imbalanced energy, become less and less and more refined until we really settle on the path of right effort eventually. Ajahn Chah, who was Ajahn Sumedho's preceptor and main teacher, was a Theravadan monk or Buddhist monk in Thailand, and he was a very ordinary, down-to-earth kind of guy in teaching the lay men and women and the monks and nuns around him. And he said, "I know the path very well. Sometimes I see somebody going down the path and they're about to fall in a ditch on the left. And I say, go right, go right. At another time, I'll see someone going down the path and they're about to wander off in the ditch on the right. And I say, go left, go left." For those of us who are listening to those instructions, we might think they're contradictory, that they're confusing. We might not know how to take it. But in each case, the instruction was appropriate to bring that person back into balance. And so throughout our practice and throughout our searching for the instruction, encouragement, inspiration, and guidance on the path, we are going to hear contradictory things. The only way to know which applies to you and when it's effective for you is to try it. That's all. You can't take somebody else's word for what worked for them. Yeah, you can. You can say, well, that worked for them then. It might or might not be appropriate for you right now. But it's just something that you keep in your little meditator's tool bag, that when necessary, I could try this or that or whatever else you've heard from all of us who have who you are sharing this path with. The Bodhisattva Siddhartha, who became the Buddha, lived in his father's palace, the king's palace, for 29 years, indulging in all the sensual pleasure that was available to a prince at that time. In spite of that, he still had an urge to understand more deeply the facts of life. Left home, went to undertake spiritual practices, and for 6 years practiced what were at that time the recognized and respected spiritual practices, which by our standards and standards then were very ascetic, extremely ascetic. Living in the open, begging for food, eating one meal a day, eating, you know, small meals at that, and just living a very austere life. And in some way, the understanding was something like, you know, kind of beating the body into submission to the mind. And so it was quite torturous, and it was really painful for the body. While engaged in that kind of practice, the Bodhisattva had a memory come to mind. And it was a memory of when he was a young boy, watching his father ritually plow a field during the festival for the spring planting and the, you know, wishing for an abundant harvest. And at that time, the prince was sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree, cool and relaxed, and just interestedly watching his father plow the field. And he spontaneously entered an exalted state of mind. His mind became great. It just came together in a very balanced place of being tranquil and alert and fully in the present moment. And when he recalled that memory, it dawned on him that maybe that was a way of achieving this understanding and peace of mind that he was seeking and seemed so elusive while undertaking these ascetic torturous practices. So he abandoned the torturous practices and set about trying to find this balance of tranquility and alertness, which in due time did support his mind opening and awakening to the truth. But it's interesting that when the Bodhisattva remembered that memory and how pleasant he felt in that exalted state of mind, he was suspicious of it, thinking, this amount of pleasure in the mind cannot be the path to awakening. He was suspicious because he'd been taught that pleasure was not, pleasure was an impediment. But he looked into his experience and he realized this was not the pleasure of sensual indulgence like he'd enjoyed as in the palace, but rather it was the delight of the mind being cool. And he recognized that as a wholesome state of mind, not an unwholesome state of mind. And so that encouraged that understanding. And it was the understanding. The experience itself could be interpreted two different ways. This pleasure is bad, to be avoided, not the path. Or this pleasure is clean, it's wholesome, and a possible path to awakening. It's the understanding of our experience, like the Bodhisattva's understanding of experience, that makes the difference. With that story, we can see that it's not what experience you have in practice that determines whether there's liberation of mind or bondage of mind. It's how you understand the experience. The Buddha's awakening, or when the Bodhisattva awakened, became the Buddha. He articulated his understanding of the path as one that was neither indulgent, like the prince in the palace, nor was it ascetic, like the hermit in the wilderness, but rather it was a path in the middle that was open, receptive, neither indulgent nor ascetic, and it was tranquil, but it was alert. It was connecting and responsive. It was not forceful nor passive, but it was just in the middle. And so it's called the middle path. Between all extremes, that place where the mind can come to ease and balance. Our challenge for each one of us in an ongoing way in practice is to monitor whether we're indulging or striving. Are we falling on the side of indulgence? And if so, we need to make an adjustment. If we're erring on the side of striving in whatever way, we need to back off or relax to come back to the middle. And that's where our learning takes place. It's to see for ourselves, to understand for ourselves, is this way of practicing indulgent, or is this way of practicing striving? And only we know. You know, for someone it can be, as Claude mentioned, it's sitting an hour and a half, and that's fine. And for others, sitting, and that's balance. And for others, sitting 45 minutes would be striving. We can hear the stories of others, but it's our own understanding of our own experience that is going to ultimately show us the way. The Buddha taught that there are four ways to kind of measure, monitor, and develop right effort. And I want to speak about them tonight because in some ways all that we do here is one of those four. The first is, and I'll speak more about it, I just want to itemize them at this point. The first is to avoid unwholesome mental states that have not yet arisen. The second is to overcome those unwholesome mental states that do happen to arise. The third is to develop wholesome mental states, not yet arisen. And the fourth is to nourish and to maintain and to bring to completion those wholesome mental states once they have arisen. Well, that's a lot of wholesome and unwholesome, arisen and unarisen, and but let me explain them a little further. But before we can go too far in understanding these four right efforts, we need to have an agreement on what wholesome and unwholesome means. And this is important because how we understand wholesome and unwholesome will condition how we apply our effort and what it is we're looking for to avoid and looking for to develop and enhance. Wholesome means those thoughts, those activities, whether spoken or acted out, that do not cause harm to oneself or others. That's wholesome. Unwholesome means those actions, whether they're thoughts or spoken or acted out, that in some way cause oneself or others harm. And when we look at the kind of harm that can be caused by wholesome or unwholesome, or by unwholesome, we're talking about not only physical harm, certainly, or emotional harm, but social harm, financial harm, psychological harm, anything that would disturb the mind or cause one's own mind or another's mind to be stressed, to be suffering, to feel to intentionally do something to cause another or oneself distress. That's a pretty refined understanding, actually. But for each one of us, we might evaluate certain behaviors or thoughts differently. I might think something's unwholesome. You might think it's quite fine. Again, it's how we understand, each one of us, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what causes harm, what does not cause harm, that makes a difference. But I have seen over the course of my practice, and I'm sure many of you have, that what we consider painful or harmful or suffering changes with practice. What we might think is really quite fine and great and happy-making at the beginning of practice, 10 years later we think, geez, that is suffering that I just couldn't see. And so our understanding of suffering and happiness changes. Therefore, the refinement of our understanding of what is wholesome and unwholesome also changes. But for each one of us, it's our own responsibility to monitor, to see for ourselves what is. Because if we act in a way contrary to our deepest understanding, that's unwholesome. For someone else, they might be quite approving and quite willing to engage in that behavior or to have that thought, not yet understanding that it causes suffering. So for each one of us, it's discovering for ourselves. There are some common standards, of course, and we should at least look at them and consider whether we can buy in or not, and start there. And then work from there to greater refinement in our understanding. Again, I just want to emphasize that it's how we understand our experience. How we understand, are these thoughts wholesome or unwholesome? Are these behaviors wholesome or unwholesome? Makes all the difference in the world. That's why, in some respects, it's dangerous territory to look at another person and judge their behavior as wholesome or unwholesome. Yeah, we can see some things for sure. The grossest stuff does cause harm. Easy to see. But within one's own mind, there may not be an intention to harm. But out of ignorance, harm comes about. Only that can be revealed through practice. That's why it's important to watch, to see within ourselves. So the first right effort is to avoid unwholesome mental states that have not yet arisen. We know that what goes on in the mind conditions what we say and what we do. What is less often acknowledged is that what we see and hear and what we're exposed to conditions the mind. But that's what this first right effort addresses. It's saying, when you know that certain activity or certain people's behavior conditions within your mind unwholesomeness, avoid it. It's not that the person is bad or wrong. Let's not blame the person. But let's recognize that certain behavior, certain beliefs, certain activities, and therefore the place where they occur, causes the mind or is more likely to condition defilements in the mind. You know, if you go to a bar, it's hard not to have a little bit of interest in participating. You know, now for you, you have to decide whether that's a wholesome or unwholesome state of mind. It's that easy. But there's much greater subtleties in the mind, of course, and in our behavior. Whether certain people, certain activities, condition defilements in your mind, only you can know, because you're paying attention to your mind. Now, wouldn't it be great if you could just avoid annoying people and people that just kind of make you angry, make you irritated, make you desire, make you do anything, make you feel jealous, make you feel envious, you know, make you feel judgmental. Avoid them all. Good luck. You know, the mind, you go to the cave, you still have your mind. So, but the Buddha did encourage, you know, avoid if you can, but if you can't, of course, then keep your mindfulness with you. So this first right effort is about avoiding. Just coming on a retreat like this, because we're avoiding so much unwholesome activity, it's just not possible here, is great for the mind. It's a relief for the mind. Just to come out, if you just come out here and just hung out for a week, you know, not even practicing, your mind would get cleaner. It'd get pure. You'd just kind of get some relief just from that. But of course, by paying attention, you guard your mind a little more and you're not obsessing about the defiled states of mind that you enjoy. Oh, well, maybe you are. I don't know. I was listening to Terry Gross on NPR, now it's a couple of years ago, and she was interviewing a poet whose work, evidently, and the poet had heard, was very popular with therapists, psychotherapists, counselors. And particularly with clients who suffer from depression. And she was reading a poem, and one of her poems, and one line of this poem really jumped out at me. It was really great. In the poem, she said, "Your mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go there alone." The mind has some dangerous neighborhoods in it. You know, the places that bog you down in fear and depression and, you know, insatiable lust and jealousy and whatever. There are those areas in the mind. And you can dwell there. You can hang out there. You can go there. But don't go without your mindfulness. Because your mindfulness will recognize when these states of mind arise, that's what's arising. That's the present moment experience to be aware of. We can't always avoid it, but we can avoid the situations, the people, the places, the things, the activities, and dwelling in those areas of our mind where unwholesome states of mind arise. This sounds a little bit like, who was it? Was it Nancy Reagan? The "just do it"? Huh? Just do it?
Yes.
Oh, just say no. Yeah, that's it. Just say no. Yeah, right. Just do it, I guess, is Nike or something. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. I'm supposed to be talking about the wholesomes, just do it. The unwholesomes, just say no. Okay. And sometimes we get it wrong. Okay. So, okay. Just say no. It sounds a little bit like the "just say no" campaign. And you might think, what a, who wants to just say no all the time? But look at it, really. It's saying no to that which causes you suffering. That's compassion. If you say no to that which causes you or others suffering, that's an act of compassion. Yes, it may be exercising restraint. It might be putting the brakes on when you're heading pell-mell to hell. But it's really compassionate action to develop this first right effort. Okay, first right effort is to avoid those mental states, defiled mental states that are not yet arisen. Second right effort is to overcome those unwholesome mental states that inevitably do arise. The first is to avoid, if at all possible. It doesn't mean to disengage from life. It means be careful that you don't just associate with those who bring out the worst in you. You know, you just don't want to hang out with those who bring out the worst in you. You know, it's not their fault. You know, it's just your choice to be there. And sometimes it just brings out the worst. And so we want to begin to recognize it, pay more attention to our inner life, so that we can recognize that. The second is to, when unavoidably unwholesome states of mind arise, deal with it. To overcome them. To engage them in such a way that they don't get the upper hand. So, we're practicing mindfulness. Even in our efforts to be awake and aware, defilements still arise. We get judgmental about our practice. We get judgmental about our other yogis, and we get irritated and frustrated and disappointed, and we get desiring and striving, and we get jealous, we get envious. You don't have to go far. It's all here. What to do? they've arisen. We're even in a wholesome place, and we're making wholesome effort, and still defilements arise. So how do we deal with them? What kind of effort is required here? Because they have arisen. Now that they've arisen, that they're coming up in the mind, what do we do with them? Well, to just say, get out, well, hello, aversion. Another defilement. And so it takes a really refined understanding of how to deal with unwholesome states of mind so that you don't just build on, you know, add another layer of defilement to that one. And this is what Sayadaw is pointing to, that, you know, it's not the experience of the defilement, it's how you're relating to it. If you're aware of the defiled state of mind, that's a wholesome state of mind. Yes, it's arising, it's trying to get in there, it's trying to get a foothold in your mind, and you're just aware of it. You're just aware, well, there's sleepiness, there's restlessness, there's desire, there's aversion, it's just trying to get, and you're just aware that that's trying to get in the mind, and trying to take over, and we know it's easy enough to get seduced. But as long as there is this stream of moments of awareness of this defiled state of mind, that's wholesome effort. That's the right effort. Now, what kind of effort is that? First of all, there's an element of patience in it, because, as we know, the defilements are insistent, they are persistent, they are tenacious, they are deeply rooted, we're deeply habituated, we're blind to them, we consider them, well, who we are much of the time. And so, of course, they're just going to arise relentlessly. And so we need to have some patience. Patience with our conditioned habits. Just understand these are arising because they're deeply conditioned in the mind. To be critical of the arising of defilements is unskillful. It's really not having very much understanding, thinking that they shouldn't be arising. Hello? You know what? We've been cultivating them day in and day out for years. Of course they're going to arise. So let's not judge the fact that they've arisen, but let's develop the second element of this effort and be persistent in being aware of them. Be patient with the defilements, but be persistent in your awareness of it. This will generate this right effort to overcome defiled mental states once they have arisen. We were talking at lunch with Sayadaw and the staff. We were having a real Dharma fest up there. Probably you heard it, but anyway. We were talking about wholeheartedness. And as soon as Sayadaw mentioned it, he was thinking, oh, something about wholeheartedness. And I realized, wholeheartedness, that's it. That's the kind of effort we need. Wholehearted effort. Because wholehearted, not half-hearted, but wholehearted effort is, the mind that is continuous, that has the intention with regularity, with continuous intention to be present, to be persistent, to be aware. That's wholehearted. If we're only there half the time, that's half-hearted. But in each moment, being aware is not that difficult. What's difficult is being aware continuously. That's where we have to kind of monitor our wholeheartedness in practice. Are we willing to engage once again familiar defilements? Because they come, you know. I mean, it'd be great if we only had to see sleepiness once, put it aside, won't come for the rest of the retreat. Hey, we'd all be done by now. You know, we've seen it. We've seen them all. But no, it comes many times a day, for many days, for many retreats, for many years. It does. But each time that we engage the defiled state of mind, whatever it is, we learn a little bit more about it. If you just have the intention to get rid of it, you can get rid of it. You can ramp up the samadhi, you can distract yourself, you can chant a little bit, you can recite the precepts and refuges to yourself. You'll get rid of it, no problem. But there's no understanding. It'll come back. The roots of that and the energy of it is still there. It's just hidden behind your intense effort to get rid of it or get away from it. But what we want to do in this practice of awareness is not just try to get rid of it, but try to learn about it. Because if we observe the defiled states of mind with the intention to understand them, then we don't care if they come. They're there, something to learn, something to observe and learn from. If they leave, fine. If they don't, equally fine. More opportunity to learn. And it is this commitment to understanding or engaging in the practice in order to learn that will make your efforts wholesome. It's a challenge. I got to admit, it's a challenge to welcome defiled states of mind and the immense continuity of energy that's required to engage them. It's not easy to like doing that. It's not easy to want to do that. It's not easy to look forward to it. It's not easy to do. But if you encourage yourself by remembering that only by engaging them with awareness are you going to begin to understand how they arise, what conditions give rise to these defilements, how long do these defilements last, what do they do to the mind, what do they do to the body, what conditions prevail when that defilement comes to an end. We can only know that by paying attention, by being aware, watching from the moment we first see it till the last moment it's present. Over the course of time, we learn. We learn the nature of sleepiness and restlessness and desire and aversion and depression, despair, and all the sources of suffering in our life. We learn slowly, bits and little bits each time. And we get a little quicker at recognizing them, a little more confidence in enduring them, a little more skill in engaging them, and gradually our understanding grows. This is the path. But it takes a willingness to engage the visitors to the mind that cause us to suffer. Sometimes I think I had this belief. It wasn't very well articulated because it wouldn't last if it was. But you have this kind of assumption or belief that if a defilement or a hindrance is present and you haven't gotten rid of it, then it's just getting stronger. It kind of seems that way, that, oh, if I'm just lost in, angry thoughts or depressed thoughts or judgmental thoughts, even though I'm trying to be aware of it and partially aware of it, somehow there's an assumption in the back of our mind that it's just getting stronger and stronger because we're not able to get rid of it. We're not able to put it aside. We're not able to fix it, so to speak. But that's a wrong understanding. Just because it's present doesn't necessarily mean that it's getting stronger. If you're engaged in it, engaged with it, and paying attention so that you learn about it, then slowly it is weakening. slowly the habit, the force of the habit, and the strength of the defilement, once it has arisen, is weakening. Every moment of awareness is like chipping off a little piece of the momentum of that habit. So we just have to keep chipping away at it. And in time, our understanding will be greater, and that state of mind won't be able to take root or get a foothold in the mind. Sayadaw says, most yogis make the mistake of expecting good experience instead of trying to work with the defilements. Been there, done that. So we have the first right effort of avoiding unwholesome mental states that have not yet arisen. The second right effort, balanced energy of engaging unwholesome mental states that have arisen. Now we get into the just do it. Third right effort is just do it. And that is to develop wholesome mental states that have not yet arisen. Take every opportunity to cultivate in the mind wholesome mental states. What's a wholesome mental state? Well, the obvious ones are love, compassion, generosity, patience, equanimity, understanding, truthfulness, all the paramis, those forces of purity in the mind, they're all wholesome. But also just even reflecting on that which you are grateful for. You know, I've seen it in a couple places recently, that one of the most effective mental activities, mental tools for engendering or bringing about a sense of well-being is to express your gratitude. We all have so much to be grateful for. Unbelievable. We just live at the top of the heap. As bad as it is for any one of us here, we are at the top of the heap of humanity. In opportunity, in resources, in intelligence, skills, we just have so much to be grateful for. Yeah, there's a lot of things we can kind of whinge and whine about, but it's hard to be happy doing that. And so just to, it sounds kind of, I don't know, just count your blessings. You know, just kind of reflect each day a little bit about the tremendous benefit we have, and to be grateful for that. And then if there's anyone that you can express your gratitude to, that is the most effective activity for engendering a sense of well-being. They call them, gratitude visit. Gratitude visit. You know, visit someone that you're grateful for and tell them. Whether it's a teacher, a mentor, you know, anyone that's ever benefited you in any way. It's like the most effective tool for engendering a sense of well-being. This is free. This doesn't cost a thing except your own willingness to try it. That's what I mean when I say arouse those wholesome mental states that are not yet arisen. If gratitude is not yet a frequent visitor to your mind, there's something you can do. Just that. Make yourself happy. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, great Tibetan teacher of the last century, he said, a crystal takes on the color upon which it is placed, whether it's white, yellow, black, red. Likewise, the people you spend your time with will make a huge difference to the direction in your life. Spending time with spiritual friends will fill you with love for all beings and help you to see how negative attachment and hatred really are. Being with such friends, following their example, will naturally imbue you with their good qualities. Sangha is really important. Important for several reasons. One of which is that it reminds you of something of value in your life. Not that the person or the people in your Sangha are always wise and compassionate and understanding. You know, they're on the path too. But it's their aspiration, it's your common aspiration to awaken that you're connecting with, that you're supporting, that you're remembering and recalling when you gather together. And what you do, whether it's a potluck or read a book or sit together or talk or go for a hike, that's less important. What's important is that you get together acknowledging that we have this common aspiration. And whatever you can do to support that is another wholesome mental state building activity. It's important to do that partly because the immensity of what we're doing is not easy to hold alone. If any one of us could see the path but no one to share the journey with, it'd be overwhelming. It just would be almost impossible to engage it. It's hard work. And if there's nobody to share your trials and tribulations, your challenges, your joys, your sorrows, your successes, and your failures with, it's hard. It's hard even with close Sangha members. So it's an immense aspiration that we're nurturing here. And whatever we can do to support a wholesome relationship to that, a kind of a confident, energetic, understanding relationship to that aspiration, that will serve you well. Actually, to just talk about the immensity of the work or the aspiration is a little bit imbalanced, because we need to also acknowledge in the same breath that all that's required in any moment is just a little more patience, a little more understanding, a little more awareness. That's all that's ever required in any moment, even though the journey is immense. Don't be overwhelmed by the immensity of your aspiration, but rather look to the simplicity of the effort that needs to be made in each moment. But get encouragement from other Sangha members to make that effort. Carlos Castaneda, another great spiritual teacher of the last century, was taught by Don Juan, another realized master of the last century. He was taught about this practice of right effort. And Carlos wrote, "Don Juan assured me that in order to accomplish the feat of making myself miserable, I had to work in a most intense fashion, and that was absurd. I had now realized that I could work just the same in making myself complete and strong. The truth is in what one emphasizes," he said. "We either make ourselves miserable or we make ourselves strong. The amount of work is the same." If we recognize that was the choice, it'd be easy, wouldn't it? But it takes understanding to recognize that in fact is the choice in each moment. We can make ourselves miserable or we can make ourselves sane. It's our choice in each moment. You know the space shuttle that they send up from Florida? and got these onboard computers with the MapQuest map on it. You know, this says how to get from Florida space station, you know, 2 miles to the left, take a, you know, 2 miles on route so-and-so, take a left, go a quarter mile, take a right, stuff like that. Well, they shoot the space shuttle up, it's heading for the station, and 98% of the time it's off course. 98% of the time it's off course. And yet, in due time, it arrives at the space station. Why? Why? Because they make innumerable mid-course corrections along the way. Well, our practice is just like that. We are off course about 98% of the time. We're making wrong effort. We're just heading off in wrong direction, wrong understanding, impatience, aversion, whatever. But when we recognize it, we make a mid-course correction and we come back. In this way, we hit the extremes, but we eventually find the middle. And that's the place of awakening. That's the place of understanding. When we come to that midpoint, we find the middle path. Then we're headed towards the goal. Forthright effort, not the most insignificant either, is to nourish and to maintain, to bring to development, to develop to completion or fulfillment, the wholesome mental states once they have arisen. For this, we need to understand what a wholesome mental state is. We need to recognize it within our own experience. Because we have hundreds of thousands of wholesome mind moments every day. Did you see them yet? Did you see them today? You know, sometimes we walk around thinking, I'm having a bad day. Grumpy, grumpy, grumpy. You know, not seeing whatever moments of calm, clarity, patience, understanding, you know, wholesome intention that we cultivate. Those are all wholesome moments. They've arisen. Keep at it. Nourish them. Nurture them. The way to nurture them is to recognize them. If we don't recognize them, if we don't recognize wholesome mental states when they arise, we'll dismiss them as insignificant. So we have to go out of our way to find them, to locate them, and to say, this is a wholesome mental state, or this is a wholesome condition. The mind is calm. The mind is not reactive. The mind is feeling gratitude. The mind is feeling generous. The mind is feeling loving. The mind is feeling energetic. The mind is feeling confident. All of those, I mean, and more, are wholesome mental states. They come. Recognize them. Only by recognizing them, well, by recognizing them, we strengthen them. We recognize them more frequently. They get a little more support. Recognizing them is also a wholesome mental state. That awareness of them. Sayadaw says, when you're in a positive frame of mind, it's important to recognize it because recognition strengthens wholesome states of mind. How much does it take to just acknowledge a state of mind? The amount of energy is, well, it's insignificant. But it still has to be done with regularity and continuity. Because it is in the continuity of our efforts, all of our right efforts, it's in the continuity of them that the mind becomes strong. That our awareness becomes strong. That we can see the wholesome mental states become strong. In any one moment, insignificant energy. But to sustain it throughout the day, that is our challenge. From wake up till sleep, just making the least amount of effort that's required. Sometimes we think, gotta make this right effort, and just gotta, it's so muscular, and it's so, it's not. Upandita, as many of you know, is demanding taskmaster when it comes to meditation, and he insists on, you know, just absolute diligence. It's from wake up to, you know, and he's a pretty imposing figure, but he's so soft and he's so gentle. When he talks about right effort, and then you got to watch this. When he talks about right effort, he squeezes his fist like this. He goes, "You got to make right effort," and he squeezes his fist like he's squeezing a feather. You know, you got to make this kind of determined right effort. You know, and it's such a kind of an anomaly type of thing. You think, oh, you got to make this right effort. You got to grip and and it's not like that. He's just sitting in his chair and he goes, "You got to make this right effort. You know, you really got to be determined." And he goes, it's a good lesson, because that's the quality of mind of right effort. It's not a tight mind. It's driving. It's gripping. It's pushing. It's a really gentle mind that can lightly hold the present moment, recognize the present moment. So these are the four right efforts. When brought into balance, move us along the path. So let's sit for a moment. It's not difficult to be aware or mindful, Sayadaw says. It's difficult to maintain it continuously. And for this, you need right effort, which is simply perseverance.